Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This week on The Wheelhouse. Rhetoric. In our politics and during times of war. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, the show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond right here. During times of war, political leaders have many weapons in their arsenals. And I'm not just talking about tanks and guns. They also have language.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Repeated acts of violence against the armed forces of the United States must be met not only with alert defense, but with positive reply.
Today we focus on Afghanistan, but the battle is broader. Every nation has a choice to make. In this conflict, there is no neutral ground.
So in this moment, we must be crystal clear. We stand with Israel. We stand with Israel. And we will make sure Israel has what it needs to take care of its citizens, defend itself, and respond to this attack.
Political leaders can wield their words to drum up support for their cause, but they can also use it to justify violence. Right now, political rhetoric is everywhere as the violence in Gaza continues to unfold. So how do we make sense of what we're hearing right now? Here to help us out are three people who think about political rhetoric a lot. Paul Auchter, the Associate Professor of Rhetoric at the University of Richmond. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Frankie. Thanks for having me.
We also have Ned O'Gorman, the professor of communication at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Good morning, Ned.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And then we have Jason Stanley, the professor of philosophy at Yale University, also co-author of The Politics of Language. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning. Great to be in conversation with this group.
Yes, very excited to talk to all three of you. And if folks want to jump in on the conversation, please give us a call, 888-720-9677. I want to know what questions you got about rhetoric in our politics, or even during war. You can join the conversation, 888-720-9677. Paul, you get the first question. Before we get to rhetoric during wartime, I really want to drill into the idea of political rhetoric more broadly. What do we mean when we say political rhetoric?
Yeah, thanks. That's a good one. I like to think of political rhetoric as something that emerges anytime a community has a gap between what they have and what they want, what they desire. And that can be, as I tell students, a community as small as their dorm when they're trying to make a policy out toward the biggest issues that we face in the world on the international stage. So it's in that gap that people have to advocate for something different. And in that engagement, and that can be written and that can be spoken, in that engagement, we have the art of rhetoric.
Is this the same thing as propaganda or no?
Sometimes. I think that that for me was a term that I associated with the 50s for a long time until more recent presidential elections, when the means of manipulating algorithms and such became part of the conversation. So I don't think it's always the same as propaganda, but propaganda is definitely a subset of rhetoric.
Ned, is political rhetoric good or bad? or does it really depend on what's said?
Yeah, well, you know, I think rhetoric is as old as democracy. I mean, the very art of rhetoric was invented just as the Athenians were coming up with this idea of democracy. So I think, and I don't think democracies can function without rhetoric for precisely the reason that Paul just laid out there, which is the gap between what is and what we desire to be. We need rhetoric in order to close that gap. That said, also going all the way back to the Greeks, right away they realized that certain speakers could abuse or manipulate the art of rhetoric in a way that is less about closing gaps, so to speak, and more about controlling audiences, controlling the people, manipulating them, deceiving them. And so, as with virtually anything, something that is good can be used for perverse purposes. So I think in general, rhetoric is a good thing, but it can certainly be used for bad purposes.
And is there a big distinction between rhetoric that's more democratic in purpose versus authoritarian? Is that kind of where you were going to?
Yeah, I think the big thing that we as citizens need to ask whenever we're exposed to rhetoric is this message or is this messenger allowing me to make judgments? Are they inviting me to make judgments? Are they inviting me to think about what is being said and make judgments? Or are they trying to control me and tell me what to believe, what to do? And I think that distinction is the vital one.
Jason, you co-wrote a book all about the politics of language this year, and you basically say all language is political, right? Is that where you're getting to? And you want to tell us more about that?
Yes. So the book was written to restructure the discipline of linguistics to focus away from just information transfer. So we have this idea that people speak and they give us reasons to believe things, but in fact, speech is more complex. This is something that literary theorists know well. It expresses social identity. It expresses affect. It expresses practices. And each word that we use has those resonances with social identity, with practices. The way you pronounce New Haven is slightly different from the way I pronounce New Haven. And that shows that reflects our backgrounds and histories. And so we're trying in our work to emphasize those non-informational aspects of speech, which locate us socially and politically.
Jason Stanley coming to us from New Haven today. And Paul, what makes political rhetoric effective or not? And what is the role in U.S. policy today, U.S. politics today, of political rhetoric?
What makes it effective, I think, is one of the big questions that we explore in the field. So there's not one great answer to that. One of the definitions of rhetoric that I really like and that I've taught is that it is the art of the adaptation of ideas to people and people to ideas. Now, as Ned was just saying, there's always an ethical component to that. So it's really difficult to talk about effective rhetoric, good rhetoric, without including ethics, something more than just did it sell the car, if it's advertising rhetoric, for example, or did it justify a war in a way that people found persuasive? So effects can be a lot of things. To add to what you were asking Ned about, you know, when do we consider rhetoric bad? The trend recently toward sort of domestic rhetoric that is enemy making is concerning to me. There's this notion of rhetoric as a persuasive art, but there's also a lot of other ways that we can think about it, that rhetoric is agenda setting, for example. The New York Times in the last couple months has shifted almost entirely from coverage of Ukraine to coverage of Israel and Hamas. I think rhetoric that encourages enemy making, that encourages us to be in our own in-group and separate from others who disagree with us, isn't always good rhetoric. And we've seen a lot of that in the last several years. That is, and I think that is kind of propagandistic or demagogic, where we end up patting ourselves on the back for feeling great that we have our in-group identity affirmed, but we are less likely to be able to engage with people who disagree with us.
What's the goal of political rhetoric, Jason? Is it to appeal to our emotions, not necessarily our logic?
Well, the goal of political rhetoric depends upon the person issuing it. I mean, the goal of political rhetoric for an autocrat, for a would-be dictator, is to create an us-them distinction of the sort that we just discussed. I think that was Ned, to create, you know, the others are fundamental enemies. They're destroying the nation. You need me to protect you. That's the goal of autocratic political rhetoric. The goal, but I think you're asking a normative question, an ethical question. What ought to be the goal of a political rhetoric in a democracy? And I think both of the panelists said really good things about this. Number one, the goal should be to invite people to make their own judgments rather than trying to manipulate them. And to appeal to, I would put it slightly differently, another way of saying the same thing, to appeal to a common humanity. That's the democratic goal of political rhetoric. To bind us together rather than divide us.
Yes, and we are zooming along here talking about really, it's impressive how this panel is crystallizing the importance really of language, not just in politics, but really in the way that we talk to one another. So, Ned, I want to know what role evolving technology played in the dissemination of political rhetoric. So I want to consider like everything from the emergence of television decades ago, you were talking about the 50s earlier, to social media platforms like TikTok today.
Yeah, well, that's a huge question. But, you know, one of the things that mass technology did, and that really began not with television, but with radio, is created a large, you know, in the millions size of audience that a speaker could speak to simultaneously. And so there's been a lot of work done on the way in which mass communication technologies like radio and television really created, in some sense, the idea of a nation and that a whole collective that could listen to a message at the same time and respond to it. Algorithmic technologies, digital technologies, almost do the exact opposite of that. They break audiences down into little micro communities. And I think a lot of the fragmentation that we are seeing in our society these days is connected to that particular power of digital algorithmic technologies to break us down into small little micro audiences rather than a large, more unified audience.
This panel doing just a fantastic job of breaking down political rhetoric, and we appreciate it very much. From Connecticut Public Radio, this is The Wheelhouse. I'm Frankie Graziano. We're going to continue with this conversation just shortly. Join the conversation if you'd like, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers. So we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. This hour, we're talking about the use of political rhetoric, including during times of war. Still with me, Paul Auchter. He's the Associate Professor of Rhetoric at the University of Richmond. Ned O'Gorman is a Professor of Communication at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And Jason Stanley, Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. Folks, what do you make of the rhetoric you're hearing from politicians right now? You got to call us. Join the conversation, 888-720-9677, 888-720-WNPR. We can't talk about political rhetoric today without talking about former President Donald Trump. Here's what he said in a recent speech.
We will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country.
Such an obsession for a history of political rhetoric from some of these lawmakers and adopting it into what we hear today. Ned, how has political rhetoric evolved during the Trump era? Has it become even more combative and polarizing?
Well, I mean, I think the obvious answer to that is yes. I think the question is why? And again, I would go back to some of the things that we were talking about right before the break in terms of the channels through which we get our messages these days are largely digital. And I think Trump has really capitalized on the power of the digital to fragment, to divide, to distance one group from another in terms of the kinds of information that they're getting, and that his rhetoric, which is highly polarizing, sort of matches or maps onto the power of the digital to polarize and to divide. And so I know that Trump could not have succeeded in the 1950s or 60s when television was becoming the dominant medium. He's just not the kind of personality that would do well in that medium, but he does very well in a digital landscape.
What do you make of recent language choices that we heard in there, like vermin and root out?
I think Jason would be a great person to speak to this because there's some history there.
Go ahead, jump in, Jason.
Well, I mean, it's almost comically Nazi, right? I mean, he's directing it not against ethnic groups, but against political enemies. You have to combine sort of two historical traditions. The Nazis, people always think the Nazis focused on Jewish people primarily at first. That was more Hitler. The Nazi propaganda was aimed at communists and socialists. The Martin Niemöller's, first they came for the communists and I said nothing, so that then they came for the trade unionists. And I said nothing, and then they finally came for me. So this focus on labeling anyone who's not pro-Trump, including Joe Biden, as a communist and Marxist, Joe Biden is right out of the past. The focus on political enemies needing to be incarcerated, extinguished. That's ironically straight out of the worst communist regimes. The Soviet Union intervened in the definition of genocide to make sure it was focused on political opponents because they didn't want to be accused of genocide. Now, what you have is Trump repeating this essentially genocidal language against political opponents, calling them communists, calling ordinary centrist Democrats communists and socialists. And it's working because, you know, the same number of Americans think that Biden is too far left as think that Trump is too far right.
I don't want to drill too far into this, but there's just such an obsession, right, with especially in wartime with the Nazis. You brought up comically Nazi as a phrase, but we've seen this with Ukraine and Russia. The words that that Russians are saying that Ukrainians are Nazis, but yet in these far right landscapes, sometimes there's just an obsession with Nazis and using phrases and things that Nazis might use.
Well, the thing that we have to pay close attention to is projection. And Trump is doing this a lot himself. Everything he says about Biden and the Democrats is true of him. And what he's trying to do, and same as with Putin and Ukraine. So what he's trying, first of all, he's signaling you as to what he's signaling what he intends to do by saying that's what the Democrats want to do. And secondly, he's muddying the waters and making the vocabulary, draining the vocabulary of meaning. Because when he says that he's the protector of democracy and not the people trying to hold him to account for a coup, that robs words like democracy of any meaning. And the Russian political technologists did the same thing. They went out to rob the democratic vocabulary of any meaning. And that's what projection does. When you project what your anti-democratic methods and intentions onto your opponents.
And which one of you wants to take this one? Also, Trump making the joke about being a dictator for a day.
Yeah, I was just thinking, just to add on to what Jason and Ned were just...
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Paul. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Trump is a master of the attention economy. And, you know, from his earliest emergence in real estate in the 80s, and he's on the record in The Art of the Deal talking about how you get attention, and you say something somewhat controversial and journalists cannot resist that. So one of the ethical concerns that we're talking about labeling his opponents vermin, etc., do serve this very anti-democratic function, and we should be concerned about that. They also serve the function of getting attention. I think there was a moment early in the presidential campaign in 2015 when he had something like 40 hours of free airtime because CNN was airing his speeches at length. And so when you combine that with the highly emotional language, when you combine that with the work of algorithms that can isolate us, that is to say, when we click on something that we like, we are shown more of it. When you look at the way that partisan news has also isolated us, you have polarization combined with the ability of each of these or the echo chambers to continually draw the same audience and then reaffirm their identity, thus cleaving in half and people. And instead of, as Jason was saying, instead of rhetoric being used to appeal to our common humanity, it's rather used to appeal to a narrow political identity, and that's concerning.
But Ned, some of that language does seem to work to at least draw a controversy or get some attention from the folks, like the dictator for a day comment. How seriously should people be taking comments like that?
Well, I think that any public figure, any major public figure, let alone a foreign president who would be willing to use that kind of language should be, I mean, there should just, it's automatically concerning, and there should be real concerns about that. At the same time, I think what Paul is saying is right on, that this is about getting attention. And here we are talking about Trump when our president is Joe Biden right now. And this is the problem that Biden is facing as he looks to a reelection campaign is precisely Trump's ability just to dominate attention on our media world.
Paul, how does political rhetoric inform violence in the U.S.? And I'm thinking about the Capitol insurrection or even like the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville.
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's such to connect rhetoric and physical violence in the world is always tricky because it's difficult to draw cause effect that any one speech or any one act could be identified as the cause is very difficult to do. At the same time, we would be doing ourselves a great disservice if we didn't recognize that speech that incites violence creates environments where violence is simply more likely to occur. So I think we need maybe some new terms, some new language to talk about this, and to, and we have some of that, verbal abuse, symbolic violence. Those terms are used in different contexts to talk about this, because it is absolutely concerning, hard to prove legally, but ethically very concerning anytime you're inciting violence.
Ned, how does political rhetoric operate during times of war? Are there certain rhetorical norms of war?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, as I've looked at the history of political rhetoric around war, or about war, maybe we should see, I think, you know, there's really kind of two types, so to speak. And one is rhetoric that is really about describing a situation and then describing a response. And I very much think of FDR's Pearl Harbor or Day of Infamy speech on December 8th, 1941, that you led the program with. If you just go read that speech, it's not a particularly moving speech in the sense of, full of highly emotional language. It's very descriptive. FDR just sort of describes what happened, and then he describes how the United States intends to respond. But then there's a very different kind of war rhetoric where a speaker will take a situation and then transform that situation, make it in a sense something bigger than the original situation itself. And the speech I think of here, and there's lots of examples of this, but the speech that I think is also an FDR speech, which is his famous For Freedom speech that was his State of the Union address on December 6, 1941, so prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor, where he is presenting to Congress a case for U.S. support for the Allied cause in World War II. And he makes it about the very future of civilization itself. And his argument is that civilization depends upon U.S. Aggressive U.S. support for the Allied cause in World War II. And so there's a war in Europe, yes, but FDR makes it about the future of civilization itself. That's a very different kind of argument. And I think that you see political leaders in war situations sort of tacking back and forth between these two general strategies.
Give me an example maybe of some peacetime rhetoric. Is it always pro-war, I guess, is the question.
I mean, there's lots of examples of rhetoric for on behalf of peace. I think of Eisenhower's famous Atoms for Peace speech, where he argues that nuclear technology should not be used for purposes of war, but for purposes of energy and industry. Most times we see that kind of rhetoric, at least in the 20th century. We do have to kind of read between the lines and ask what else is going on here.
Jason, I'm going to play some language used by President George W. Bush during his war on terror.
Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists. From this day forward, any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as a hostile regime.
We talked about how language from our political leaders can create in and out groups and us versus them mentality. What are the consequences of that, Jason?
Well, the consequences of this, as to go back to Ned's point about inviting people to make judgments, are to crush people's capacity to make judgments. I mean, if you want to get people to tune out the people you're targeting, call them terrorists, call them pedophiles. because then, you know, if someone who's a terrorist or a secret pedophile is telling you something, you're just going to tune it out because they're just doing it to further their nefarious goals. So in wartime, you want to shut down debate. You want to shut down judgment. You just want people to take your side. And what we're seeing right now is a couple things related to that quote. So first of all, Bush is calling anyone who opposes his policy a terrorist. So anyone, even domestically, who's like, maybe the war on terror is going too far, or maybe the Iraq war is really problematic, he's calling them a terrorist. He's saying, you know, you're either with us or against us. And we're seeing that right now with the Gaza war. We're seeing the right wing, in fact, very cynically, because many of the people promoting this have also spread anti-Semitic conspiracy theories like great replacement theory. But we're seeing Republicans basically take on this vocabulary of terrorism and aim it at universities and being like, well, huh, there are universities who are critical of Israeli politics, so they're really just terrorists. So they're using this way of thinking about the world where you divide the world into, you know, us into really brutal friend-enemy distinctions, which are at the root of fascism. And you say that anyone, you know, and then you direct them at domestic targets like university professors. You say, look, the university professors, they're saying it's more complicated. So they're really just terrorists, too.
A bit of history from FDR to George W. Bush through Donald Trump's presidency. And now we're going to zoom ahead to right now and political rhetoric being used in today's age. 888-720-9677, the number to call if you want to have a comment or get on the air with us. 888-720-9677. Keep listening after the break. You're in the Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
If you've never donated to this station before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days. And thanks.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. All hour, we're examining political rhetoric, especially during times of war. We're zooming in on the language political leaders are using at this moment, not necessarily their policies or actions. Still with me are Paul Ochter, the Associate Professor of Rhetoric at the University of Richmond, Ned O'Gorman, Professor of Communication, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Jason Stanley, Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. What's some of the rhetoric you're hearing right now? Join the conversation, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677. Ned, how is language shaping the current war between Israel and Palestine, and is it a war of words?
Well, it clearly has an element of being a war of words, but to what's happening in Israel and in Gaza right now is not primarily about words. I think what is striking about, and I think Jason was pointing to this earlier, about what is happening in Israel, Gaza right now, is the polarized, again, we're coming back to this theme, the polarized nature of the rhetoric. It's very hard to find a kind of middle voice, in at least among those who are defining the conversation about the war that is happening there. And so, you know, you have the extremes in some ways dominating the conversation.
Public figures and news organizations, including this one, even differ in what they're naming what's happening right now. Some say it's the Israel-Hamas war, others the war in Gaza, and there are others who say war isn't the right term at all. They use genocide instead. How political is what we're even calling this?
Yeah, those are really important. The terms that are used to describe the situation are very important. I'm a Midwesterner who moved to Georgia for graduate school, and only then did I learn that the Civil War was also called the War of Southern Oppression and the War of Northern Aggression. So there are motivations that we can trace through those very terminologies, such as the power of language.
And Paul, how does political rhetoric kind of flatten history and context?
Yeah, I think to talk about all of the, you know, this vast history of armed violent conflict in, you know, in similar terms does flatten it, certainly. Ned was saying earlier, you know, that someone like Trump probably would not have emerged in the 1950s, that his is a distinctly kind of rhetoric that is suited to the digital age. Likewise, I've been thinking too, not just about the language, but about the visuals of current conflict. So Volodymyr Zelensky has been wearing kind of army colors, olive green. He switched over from suits once Russia attacked Ukraine, and Netanyahu likewise has taken to wearing almost all black in public settings in a lot of his speeches. So I'm also trying to get us to be attuned to what the visual what visual rhetoric does too, because you know, we're in a visual age where the image and the photography and all of those aesthetics impact us as well on a different level, of course, but are definitely strategic choices by those two leaders.
Essentially, what Paul is saying is that there are levels to this rhetoric. Thank you for bringing up visual rhetoric as well. Ned, common refrain we're hearing from most politicians right now in the U.S., listen to this.
Israel has the right, indeed the obligation, to defend itself and to ensure that this never happens again.
And like any other country, Israel has the right to defend itself.
I'm not shy about my belief that Israel has a right to defend itself.
I continue to believe that Israel has a right and responsibility to defend itself.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and Connecticut Senators Chris Murphy and Richard Blumenthal, who you heard in that great clip put together by Meg Dalton. Hey, what do people hear when they hear that? And what's the impact of hearing it again and again?
I think it normalizes anything Israel does. So anything Israel does, even the massive overreaction, as I would put it, it was a horrific terrorist attack by Hamas that every decent human being should condemn. However, Israel is massively overreacting. And if you keep on just calling that Israel is a right to defend itself, you're whitewashing any kind of overreaction.
This week, President Joe Biden sounded like he was maybe agreeing with you, Jason, at least a little bit, saying that Israel was losing support for its war in Gaza. And I say losing support in quote, that's what he used. Does that language mean anything to you, Jason?
I just think he's making the obvious point that when you kill thousands and thousands and thousands of children, given that it's a pretty primitive thing we should all agree on, don't kill kids, that Israel's going to lose support. So I don't think that was as much rhetorical as much as just like a statement of fact. You can say all you want, Israel's a right to defend itself. But at a certain point, when you're doing collective punishment and killing children and families, they're going to lose support.
So maybe not as incendiary as the kind of rhetoric we're hearing from political leaders in Israel, including Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, language like human animals, erase Gaza, the word eliminate's been used. What can that kind of political rhetoric do, Jason?
It can justify dropping slabs of concrete on children, which is what we're witnessing right now. It completely removes the humanity of innocent people, and justifies collective retribution. So that's, you know, you need to do that. Countries need to do that when they're engaging in mass atrocities of the sort that we're witnessing.
Yeah, and Frankie, I want to jump in here. You know, thinking about this in the long view, you know, I've read and studied war speeches from the past, all the way back to antiquity. And one of the things that is very striking about the rhetoric of war in the 20th century, and we're seeing it persist in the 21st century, is that, you know, war talk, so to speak, used to be about domination and liberation. Those who were perpetuating the war were seeking to dominate another group, and that group was seeking liberation from domination. In the last 100 years or so, and I think really we can look to World War I as a turning point, but especially World War II, war has become much more about existence itself, the existence of a people, the existence of a civilization, the existence of a nation, and that's it's hard to talk about or fight, for that matter, a just war, so to speak, if the whole matter is framed in terms that are existential, the very existence of a nation, the very existence of a people. And I'm not therefore justifying that rhetoric, but I am saying that that rhetoric provides a sort of basis for extreme acts in war. And Israel's not the first to do that. The United States did that in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
We just have a couple of minutes left here. Jason, most of the rhetoric from political leaders in the U.S. has been in support of Israel, but we've also seen politicians who support Palestinians, like Representative Rashida Tlaib, come under fire for the language using right now. The only Palestinian American in Congress was censured by colleagues in the House. Here's Tlaib's comments.
I have to say this. But Palestinian people are not disposable. We are human beings, just like anyone else. My Siti, my grandmother, like all Palestinians, just wants to live her life with freedom and human dignity we all deserve. Speaking up to save lives, Mr. Chair, no matter faith, no matter ethnicity, should not be controversial in this chamber.
What do we think about this here as we're getting short on time? How should we be thinking about this kind of political rhetoric?
She's Palestinian, for goodness sake. She has every right to feel upset and to represent a perspective that she is. The idea that a Palestinian cannot be emotional about this moment, cannot... in a democracy, we need everyone's perspective to make judgments. As I think it was Ned who said, to make judgments, we need information about other people's perspective. She's the only Palestinian American in Congress. Her job is to give us the perspective of Palestinians.
A big thank you so much to Jason and our experts. We wanted to squeeze in some more, but that's all we have time for helping us sift through this war of words. Thank you so much. Great show today, produced by Meg Dalton, technical producer Kat Pastor. Thank you so much to Tess Terrible for helping us in studio. Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse.